Welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized today's event. I'd like to welcome our audience here in San Francisco Live and also our radio and online audiences. And you can visit us at www.commonwealthclub.org whenever you want. We give over 400 events a year here. And tonight's event, it's my great pleasure to introduce Michael Lee. Michael Lee will not be speaking, but he will be introducing our speaker, Miriam Powell. We don't always do this, but this is a very special event for the Commonwealth Club. 30 years ago, not quite today, but within a couple of days at this time in November, Cesar Chavez spoke here at the Commonwealth Club. It's a very famous speech of his. It's been recorded and it's been quoted often. And Michael introduced him 30 years ago at that speech. Michael was the program chair, the quarterly program chair for the Commonwealth Club at the time, and had took a lot of other leadership positions in the club at that time. He's also been president of the San Francisco Bar Association, and he has done many, many other things here in the city. But we thought we would bring this back and say how both the Commonwealth Club helped further the cause. I think it was Shirley Temple Black that asked him, it was the year that she was president, and that she asked him to come and speak here. To give him a broader, wider-ranging voice to say what he was doing and why he was doing it. So, without further ado, I'd like to have Michael come up and introduce Miriam. Thank you very much.
Thank you, George. To paraphrase George Hammond, on November 9th, 1984, at the personal invitation of then-President Shirley Temple Black, Cesar Chavez gave one of his most memorable addresses of his storied career at a lunchtime program of the Commonwealth Club of California. It was my honor and privilege to introduce him that day, 30 years ago, and it is now my honor and privilege to introduce Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Miriam Powell, whose recent book, The Crusades of Cesar Chavez, is the first comprehensive bibliography of this courageous, complex, visionary, single-minded, and controversial organizational genius who became one of the most celebrated Latinos in U.S. history, but somewhat now slipped from the public consciousness. Now, with 30 years of hindsight, we certainly welcome Ms. Powell's insights into the legacy and lessons of this historic figure. Ms. Powell is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and recipient of a National Endowment for the Humanities Fellowship, a native of New York and a graduate of Harvard University. Ms. Powell now lives in Southern California. Ms. Powell began her journalistic career as a reporter and ultimately became assistant managing editor of Newsday in New York, before moving to California and ultimately becoming assistant managing editor of the Los Angeles Times, earning Pulitzer Prizes at both newspapers. Ms. Powell's newest book beautifully but unsparingly dissects Cesar Chavez's fabled history, from humble migrant worker to national icon, as he conceived and executed strategies that empowered the poor, uneducated, and dispossessed farm worker, and for a time defeated California's mighty growers, only to later transition to what some critics called a cult of personality, with unfortunate consequences to the union and to the movement that he had so tirelessly and brilliantly built. Ms. Powell massively and meticulously researched this book, including reviewing Cesar Chavez's voluminous personal papers that he had donated to Wayne State University in Detroit, going to Detroit to do that, and listening to hundreds of taped interviews and UFW board meetings to give us this invaluable look into Cesar Chavez. So please join me in warmly welcoming celebrated journalist and author Miriam Powell.
Thank you, Mike. Can you guys hear me? So thank you both for your introductions, and it's a real pleasure to be here and a particular honor to be speaking on the anniversary of Cesar Chavez's historic address to the same forum. The speech you delivered 30 years ago on November 9th, 1984, stands today as arguably Chavez's most memorable speech. It offers us a mirror of a complex man who was then the nation's preeminent Latino icon and remains the country's most important Latino leader in modern times. Chavez's speech embodies the contradictions that made him so heroic and so tragic, so Herculean and so human. So I can think of nothing more appropriate for this occasion than to use his speech as a roadmap in an effort to explore and hopefully illuminate some of the paradoxes of Cesar Chavez. Analyzing his talk will naturally lead to some reflections about what has changed in the past 30 years and what has remained the same. And because I am a journalist and a historian, I'll weave in some thoughts about the differences between those two disciplines from the perspective of a writer who inhabits both worlds. And I'll try to give you some insight along the way into both how and why I wrote this book. Chavez was not fond of giving speeches, neither am I actually, and he did not deliver them particularly well. But his Commonwealth Club speech came at something of a crossroads for his movement, and he composed it with unusual care. The speech he delivered illustrates dichotomies that are critical to understanding Cesar Chavez. It is visionary and short-sighted, inspiring and tragic, upbeat and elegiac. Chavez chose this venue, the nation's oldest public affairs forum, to speak to establish his legacy at a moment when his farmworkers' union had sunk to one of its lowest points. The enduring power of his speech underscores a duality that characterized so much of Chavez's life and work. He focused on the fight of the hour, even as his eyes were fixed on a distant horizon. His speech was aimed at two very different audiences at once. With incendiary phrases, he rallied supporters to fight the injustices of the moment. And in quiet, thoughtful language, he crafted a message for generations yet unborn. Journalism, it is sometimes said, is the first cut of history. And on November 9th, 1984, Chavez's diatribe against the pro-grower administration of then-governor, California Governor George Dukmejian, made headlines as he knew that it would. Fiery Chavez speech pins Dukmejian. Chavez lashes out at governor. Chavez says Duke has paid growers with blood, sweat of farm workers. The news reports did not include or reflect the title that Chavez actually chose for his talk, which was more suitable for perhaps a term paper than a major speech. What the future holds for farm workers and Hispanics in California. The prosaic title was typical of his flat writing and speaking style, but it nonetheless indicated the direction he wanted to take. And his predictions about the future, which obliquely reflect his thoughts about his own place in history, are the parts of the address that we still quote today. I know there are dozens of speeches that are given each year at the Commonwealth Club. Many of them are very historic, but I suspect that Chavez's speech is one of the most oft quoted. And yet the quotes that we cite today were scarcely mentioned in the many journalists' accounts of the speech. And that's part of what I enjoy the most about being a historian as opposed to a journalist, which is the opportunity to go back and examine and probe and reassess events with the benefit not only of hindsight, but also of significantly more access to people and to documents. A historian whom I admire uses a phrase to describe how he views his role, and it's an old Chinese proverb. The historian is the hand that rectifies. I've never actually found the proverb, and I looked for it, but I love the idea, and I've often thought about that and repeated it many times because I've seen that as part of my responsibility, both as a journalist for many years and more recently as a scholar, to try to be the hand that rectifies. So as a writer, I pay a great deal of attention to beginnings and to endings. Many of you probably have had the experience of picking up a book and reading a few pages and putting it down and never opening it again. If I don't capture readers' attention right away, I risk losing them forever. The same thing is true of speeches, but you're kind of a captive audience. So the opening of books or opening of anything that I write is always the part that I labor over the hardest. When I was writing my first book, one of the best editors I know gave me some really good advice. He said that a prologue should leave readers feeling the way you want them to feel when they finish the entire book. And my prologue in this biography begins and ends with Chavez's Commonwealth Club speech. And I've already touched briefly on some of the ways that the speech reflects Travis's character and place in history, and I'll expand on those in a few minutes. But another key reason that I chose to frame the prologue around that speech is that symbolically, Chavez's address also marked an ending, the end of his best-known crusade, the fight to establish a union for farm workers. Certainly, most people did not leave lunch at the Sheraton Palace Hotel 3 decades ago with anything close to that impression. And I'm sure that there are some Chavez partisans who would still argue that he never gave up the struggle to build a union. Nor did the accounts of the event at the time convey that sentiment. But analyzing his speech as a historian, his concession is not only clear, it's what makes the speech so significant and so memorable all these years later. He spoke 3 days after Ronald Reagan had been reelected president in a landslide. The labor movement in general was foundering 2 years after the air traffic controllers strike that broke the union. Jerry Brown, our once and current governor, was out of office, and I think that even the very visionary Cesar Chavez could not have foreseen that he would be back in the governor's seat 30 years later. And the UFW battled a hostile Republican administration in Sacramento. Most of its hard-won contracts had expired and were gone for good. Chavez acknowledged those realities, although he blamed growers and Republicans and took no responsibility himself. But then he went on to say that, in effect, it wouldn't matter, delivering a eulogy for his own movement. Chavez recognized, as he told the audience, that his place in history had been secured by his union's remarkable accomplishments in the fields of California, where he had shown that the poorest workers could take on the most powerful industry and win. But he foresaw that his ultimate legacy would be far from the fields where he achieved those David versus Goliath victories. Those triumphs would instead serve to inspire Latinos who never worked a day in the fields. Unions, like other institutions, he said, can come and go. He had begun organizing farm workers in 1962 because that was his life. That was where he came from, traveling the migrant circuits as a 12-year-old and working in the fields full-time after he graduated from 8th grade. He spoke movingly about his own experiences, about watching his parents suffer, smoldering at the indignation and the exploitation and the racism. That was the wellspring of his passion for righting those wrongs and founding a farm workers' union. As he pointed out, almost every Mexican-American in California in 1984 could trace their roots directly to farm workers and had close family ties to those who labored in the fields. But Chavez looked ahead to a time when that would no longer be the case, when Latinos would be the children of doctors and lawyers, and their connection to the farm worker movement would be increasingly tangential. The struggles of their ancestors would become history, and the story of the farm worker's success would become a model of what could be accomplished through collective action. Hundreds of thousands of farm workers in California and in other states are better off today because of our work, Chavez said. And Hispanics across California and the nation who don't work in agriculture are better off today because of what the farm workers taught people about organization, about pride and strength, about seizing control over their own lives. This is still the quote. Tens of thousands of children and grandchildren of farm workers and the children and grandchildren of poor Hispanics are moving out of the fields and out of the barrios and into the professions and into business and into politics. And that movement cannot be reversed. Our union will forever exist as an empowering force among Chicanos in the Southwest. That force did not depend on the union's size, he said. It didn't matter whether the union had 100,000 or 500,000 members. In actual fact, the UFW never had more than 100,000 members at its peak in 1970. By 1984, when he spoke, the number was probably closer to 30,000. The truth was by the time he addressed the Commonwealth Club, Chavez's movement had already moved far from the fields, and for farm workers, that mattered a great deal. In 1965, when the Delano grape strike began and few people had ever heard the name Cesar Chavez, he gave an interview where he mused at length about what he wanted his organization to become. He warned of the dangers of becoming a traditional labor union. "We have to find a cross between being a union and a movement," he said. As long as the union was at war, bravely taking on the state's most powerful industry, that mix wasn't terribly hard to achieve. The movement's spirit was part of what attracted armies of volunteers. But a decade later, in peacetime, with dozens of contracts and tens of thousands of union members expecting services, Chavez found the competing demands harder and harder to balance. By the late 1970s, discussions at the union's executive board meetings, which, as Mike said, were taped, routinely devolved into agonizing debates about philosophy. The time has come, we have to choose between being a movement and a union, his brother Richard, who was also on the board, and the practical brother would say. To Richard and to many of those who had worked with Chavez for years, the answer seemed clear. They had been fighting to build a union. But Caesar was equally clear. If he had to choose, he would forsake the union in order to preserve what he considered the movement spirit. He talked about building a poor people's union and setting up collectives, although he never really articulated a plan, and the idea stayed a dream. By 1984, the consequences of Chavez's choices were very clear. The public, for the most part, did not see that, but farm workers knew. In the fields of California, many had concluded that Chavez had effectively destroyed the union that they had labored so hard together to build. Workers felt abandoned, confused, and betrayed. Those feelings were shared by many of the most talented union staff who had helped propel the United Farm Workers to its heady successes in earlier decades. But almost nobody talked about it. The ethos of the movement was that one did not air dirty linen in public. And despite their disappointment and anger, most XUFW staff and supporters still believe that Cesar Chavez represented the best hope to improve the conditions and the lives of farm workers. So they were loath to say anything that might make that struggle any harder. Chavez cast his retreat from the fields in different terms. He was changing with the times, he explained to the Commonwealth Club audience. We must translate the importance of a union for farm workers into the language of the 1980s, he said. Instead of talking about the right to organize, we must talk about protection against sexual harassment in the fields. We must speak about the right to quality food and food that is safe to eat. The boycott, once a bold move that catapulted farm workers into the national consciousness, was no longer about picketing stores and asking consumers to forego grapes so that farm workers could have contracts. The new boycott was high tech for the time. Not volunteers in supermarket parking lots, but computerized direct mail. The demand was not for contracts, but something so amorphous it never was really clearly articulated. At first, Chavez said the boycott was aimed at forcing the state to enforce its laws. Then he changed the target to demand that growers stop using certain pesticides. His appeals to supporters were not so much about improving the lives of farm workers as about convincing consumers not to eat unhealthy produce. The boycott was one of two trends that he cited that made him optimistic about the future, he said in the Commonwealth Club speech. And his twin hopes mirror his blind spot and his prescient vision. The boycott would lead to improvements in the fields, he promised. But the connection was tenuous, and the boycott never achieved the success of its early years. The boycott succeeded in disrupting growers' operations, but the response was to change the way they operated in order to avoid the union. The boycott of the 1980s was indirectly responsible for bagged baby lettuce, which we now enjoy, and for the rise of farm labor contractors, but it did not better the lives of farm workers. But time has vindicated Chavez on his second prediction, the one that may have sounded much more far-fetched at the time. The other trend that gives us hope, he said, is the monumental growth of Hispanic influence in this country. And what that means in increased population, increased social and economic clout, and increased political influence. He cited recent statistics. More than 400 elected judges, city council members, mayors, and legislators in California, double the number of just a decade earlier. 1.1 million Spanish surnamed registered voters. Today, that figure is 3.5 million, with almost as many who are eligible but not registered to vote. We have looked into the future, and the future is ours, Chavez said, one of the most oft-quoted phrases from his Commonwealth Club speech. History and inevitability are on our side. The farm workers and their children and the Hispanics and their children are the future in California. 20 and 30 years from now, in Modesto and Salinas, in Fresno, in Bakersfield, in the Imperial Valley, And in many of the great cities of California, those communities will be dominated by the children and the grandchildren of farm workers. Last month, as most of you I'm sure know, Kevin DeLeon was sworn in as the first Latino leader of the state Senate in California. Antonio Villaraigosa served as the mayor of Los Angeles for 8 years. Salinas, Delano, and many other cities have had Latino mayors. At the time that Chavez addressed the Commonwealth Club, his fading status in the field had not tarnished his national reputation. A 1983 Los Angeles Times poll showed that Latinos ranked Chavez as the most famous Latino, ahead of pitching sensation Fernando Valenzuela and actor Ricardo Montalban. Less tied down by union business in the 1980s, Chavez traveled more and became a speaker in great demand on college campuses. He became, ironically, the face of the Chicano movement, a movement that he had once eschewed. Today in the fields of California, and this has been a standing line for the last 10 years that I have been writing about farm workers, if you ask farm workers who Cesar Chavez is, they think that you're talking about a famous Mexican boxer by the same name. And Chavez's prophecy about rising political power has been more relevant in urban areas than in the valleys where he once held sway. The power in agricultural communities today still rests largely with those who control its most important industry. Chavez's boast in his speech that the growers were punch-drunk old boxers past their prime was wishful thinking. I don't know how many people have seen the movie that came out in the spring, Cesar Chavez, the biopic, but in that movie, there's a scene where the principal grape grower, the evil grape grower, played by John Malkovich, turns to his son and says with anguish, "All I ever wanted was to turn this company over to you." That son, that grower is modeled on the real live John Jamara Sr., who was then the largest grape grower in California. And the implication is that his agricultural empire is crumbling in the face of the UFW's boycott and increased clout. The movie ends where, in my view, a Hollywood movie about Cesar Chavez should end, with the historic signing of the contracts in July 1970 with all of the major table grape growers in the state. But today, the son, who is so distraught in the movie, John Jamara Jr., presides over a thriving company, and the UFW has no members in the table grape vineyards of California. The litany of problems that Chavez recited 3 decades ago about the living conditions of farm workers could essentially be repeated today. Some things have improved. There is greater access to health care and more Spanish-speaking health professionals, although most farm workers still lack insurance and are not covered under Obamacare because most of them are, the vast majority are undocumented. There are health and safety laws on the books, but the labor contractors who Chavez sought to put out of business are now back in full force. In real dollars, wages are in many places worse than at the height of the union's power and its best contracts in the early 1980s. Housing is still a huge problem. Farm workers live in cars in the Coachella Valley and pay exorbitant rents to share rundown apartments in the Central Valley. At the very start of his address, Chavez talked about farm workers living under the trees burrowed into canyons near the tomato fields in San Diego and drinking out of irrigation pipes. That very scene is what first drew me into writing about the story of Cesar Chavez and the UFW, when I found out a decade ago that farm workers lived under the shadow of Legoland in makeshift homes made of cardboard in the 21st century. As a baby boomer who had grown up boycotting grapes, I wondered how this was possible. And then I wondered, where was the UFW? I didn't realize it for quite some time, but that launched me on what would end up being the focus of my work for the next 10 years. Today, the ignorance of Chavez extends well beyond the field. He's barely known even in California and the Southwest. He's a face on a postage stamp, a day off from school, a name on countless streets and schools. When Diego Luna was promoting his recent biopic about Chavez, he stood on an Austin street corner on Cesar Chavez Boulevard and asked passersby if they knew who he was. Half a dozen people couldn't answer. Several said Hugo Chavez of Venezuela. At an advanced screening of the movie before a large audience in Washington, D.C., U.S. Labor Secretary Thomas Perez lamented that people knew that Chavez had something to do with farm workers, but, quote, they can't really get to the next sentence. And that's why I wrote this book, because more than 20 years after his death in 1993, there still had been no comprehensive biography. By the time I began researching the history of Chavez and the movement, the myths about him were firmly entrenched. They had been written into textbooks, taught in California schools, and repeated in scholarly work, often despite clear documentation to the contrary. Some are basic factual errors, others are major omissions, or areas that are lightly glossed over. They share two things: an unquestioning acceptance of Chavez's word as gospel, and a commitment to present him in saintly terms, to skip over problematic or controversial parts of his movement, and to steer clear altogether of his failures. And yet, those failures are amply documented, thanks to Cesar Chavez. Because even as he carefully created his own legends, he was committed to preserving a meticulous historic record that often contradicted those very legends. I was able to write this book because he saved everything, not only documents, but hundreds of tapes. In 1967, he arranged for the Walter Reuther Labor Library at Wayne State University in Detroit to become the official repository of the UFW archives. From then on, all union staff were directed to send everything to Wayne State. And there may be people here who volunteered for the union, and everyone just boxed everything up and sent it there. And there are still dozens, if not hundreds, of boxes that have never even been opened. And there are also hundreds of tapes on reel-to-reel tape recorders. When I talk to younger audiences and I do a PowerPoint, I show a picture of a reel-to-reel tape recorder because they've never heard of such a thing. And I spent many hours in front of it. As an organizer, Chavez built a mythology that he used to further his goals, but he understood that once he was gone, the myths would no longer matter. The next leader would have to invent his or her own mythology. Chavez was conscious of his historical importance. As an autodidact and an avid reader of history, he understood that his place in history would be assured through his actions, and he made sure that every footprint could eventually be unearthed and studied. He said that he wanted his story told, warts and all, after he was gone. I undertook this book because I became persuaded that the lack of serious scholarship about Chavez until quite recently was in large part responsible for the fact that he was rapidly disappearing from our collective memories. And that should not be allowed to happen. It's important not to lose sight of his remarkable achievements. With an eighth grade education, Cesar Chavez built the first successful union for farm workers and masterminded a national grape boycott that forced California's most powerful industry to sign contracts with its poorest workers. He changed working conditions in the fields and empowered poor people with a sense of their own strength. He trained a generation of activists who continue to pass on his legacy in social justice battles around the country today. And then, driven by his vision, the charismatic leader effectively destroyed the union that he had built. And I also embarked on this project with the hope, which I think has been borne out by response to the book, that people are smarter and more forgiving than sometimes we give them credit for. They can accept and even embrace a hero with imperfections and understand that heroes have flaws too. The word hero derives from the Greek word, and I was a classics major, but I think we need to return to thinking about heroes as the Greeks did. Greek heroes were the offspring of a god and a mortal, and divinity granted them superpowers, but it was their mortality that rendered them compelling. It is not the feats of strength, but their human struggles that make Greek heroes ever relevant and capture our imagination centuries after their stories were first told. Cesar Chavez's life should serve as a source of inspiration, provoking spirited conversation and debate about choices, tactics, and fate. Was his degree of sacrifice necessary to be an effective organizer? What are the true costs of such commitment? When does hero worship morph into cult of personality? What are the consequences? Was he a product of his times? Could a similar movement succeed today? Is a charismatic leader necessary to effect monumental change? How can a movement preserve democracy and yet continue to move forward? And how can a movement transition into being a lasting organization? I think his legacy is more relevant today than ever. Many of the issues today are the very same ones that he took on when he first began organizing in communities around California, even before he founded the Farm Workers Union. The right to vote, the right to citizenship, the right to a decent education. Labor and progressive movements are struggling and can no longer reliably turn to political allies. Chavez's model of grassroots organizing in the community, his ability to empower people who felt powerless and disenfranchised, and his success even in the absence of laws or political power that protected the workers he organized, all of those are a model that needs to be studied today. I want to close with one final quote from Chavez's Commonwealth Club speech. "The union's survival," he said, "its very existence, sent out a signal to all Hispanics that we were fighting for our dignity, that we were challenging and overcoming injustice, that we were empowering the least educated among us, the poorest among us. The message was clear. If it could happen in the fields, it could happen anywhere, in the cities, in the courts, in the city councils, in the state legislatures. I didn't really appreciate it at the time, but the coming of our union signaled the start of great changes among Hispanics that are only now beginning to be seen. I've traveled through every part of this nation. I have met and spoken with thousands of Hispanics from every walk of life, from every social and economic class. And one thing I hear most often from Hispanics, regardless of age or position, and from many non-Hispanics as well, is that the farm workers gave them the hope that they could succeed and the inspiration to work for change." And that is one of the best descriptions of the legacy of Cesar Chavez and why I think it's so important that his story be read, studied, debated, and understood. Thank you very much.
I'd like to remind our audience that they're listening to Miriam Powell, the author of The Crusades of Cesar Chavez. And it's time for questions here at the club. And as I said, you can come up and ask your questions here. I can start with one great final quote. "Why is it that we always want our heroes, if you go back to the ancient Greek, their heroes, to be perfect?" It's a very interesting thing. I do a lot of other programs where we talk about the highlights of human history, that kind of thing, and people all say, well, we could never achieve anything today because everything is such a mess. But everything has always been achieved during a mess. It's always been a mess, and therefore it's interesting that we do that about our civilization, we do that about our heroes. It must be an interesting to study one man like that.
I totally agree, and I think it's interesting. And when Nelson Mandela died, there was some conversation about that, and the response in this country particularly, we seem to want our heroes to be perfect and to not talk about the parts that somehow are the flaws or the weaknesses. And I don't know historically why that is true. People have taught courses on heroes. But, when you think of Greek heroes and you think of Achilles, Achilles' heel is part of what made him who he was. And so I do sort of think we need a fuller picture of what it means to be heroic. And I've often said, Chavez gets compared to Martin Luther King often, and no matter what has come out about Martin Luther King, and plenty of negative things have come out about him, it has never taken away from his importance and his place in history and his legacy. And the same thing is true about Cesar Chavez.
Yeah. Great. Questions? As I said, we've only got this one mic.
It's taped
down, so if you have a question, come on up here.
I know that Eastern Michigan is a union part of the country, but why Wayne State?
Why Wayne State? Why she asked why the archives of the UFW and Cesar Chavez are in Michigan or at Wayne State. It's a great story, actually. They are at what is known as the Walter P. Reuther Labor Library, named after Walter Reuther, who was the leader of the UAW, and in 1967, a young state archivist from Michigan named Philip Mason decided he wanted to capture labor history, that the history that was being written in Michigan was only very one-sided. And so he went to Ruther, and Ruther, in effect, endowed money to create this labor library. And Ruther was one of the very important early supporters of the UFW. There are famous pictures of him in 1965 marching with Cesar Chavez. The UFW probably provided more financial support throughout the years for the UFW than any other single organization. And so Ruther in 67 went to Phil Mason and said, you need to go to this place called Delano, California, and I've made an appointment for you to go meet someone named Cesar Chavez because there's history being made there and you need to explain to him the need to preserve it. And so Phil Mason went to Delano in 1967, and the Chavez agreed to then designate this library, which was just really in its infancy, as the official repository. So that's why it's there. Many of the prominent unions in the country have their records at that library. It is not the most convenient location for everyone, but it's Detroit. So really because of the UAW.
So if you'd like to ask your question from where you're sitting, that's all right, and then we'll repeat it. Or you can come up. Go ahead.
The question was, what has been the response of the Chavez family and the UFW leadership to my book? And at least one person in the audience is laughing at the question because she knows the answer. I'm not their favorite person. They did not like stories that I wrote for the Los Angeles Times about the union, and so they have not cooperated. I knew going in that that would be the case, and because of the wealth of material that is available, not only at Wayne State, but there are a number of other very significant archives that that I explain in the book, I didn't need their cooperation in order to do the book. So they have not overtly responded to the book in any way, but they're not sympathetic to me.
And do they dispute facts, or do they dispute tone? Or both.
We have a volunteer to answer that question.
Okay. Yes.
I'm Mary Moses. I worked with the union for a very, very long time, and I was very close to Cesar and the family. In fact, I just saw Helen Chavez about a month ago when I was down on the bus, and I think I'm probably the only one on the planet that's in the same room as Mary, and also in the same family.
Yeah.
They see her, and they tell me this. I know this. They think that she, in some way, she is against them, and that she's trying to run Cesar down. And I've told them, I said, you should read that book. I said, it's wonderful. Mm-hmm. It's really, really wonderful. But they see her as a traitor, basically, and particularly the younger children. Uh-huh.
Collaborating with the trader. Yeah. I think part of it is that they feel that they have ownership. I mean, the things that have been repeated to me is that they feel, and this is the case with the King family and other comparable families, that they should have ownership of the story and that no one else should tell it. And the movie is their version of the story, and that's fine. And but I think that there's certain spot there. Yes. The image is very important to them, and partly it's important financially to them because the current incarnation of the UFW and its affiliate, which is really the Chavez Foundation, is the more important part of that, makes its money off of his reputation and his name, and so that's why the image is so important to them.
It would seem, though, that since he had this other big, broader effect, that bringing that up would be useful, although I've seen that in a lot of other organizations as well, where there's a leader who has a big, broad mandate, but the followers or the people that are in the group have a very restricted viewpoint about what he actually accomplished. So,
yeah, I think the key point is what Marion said, which is the desire to sanitize the reputation and to preserve, which they succeeded in doing for many years. I mean, the reason that there has been no biography until now, he died in 1993, and people are shocked when they hear that there has been no biography. And the reason is because people who knew that he was complicated and that he was not a purely saintly figure, as no one is, didn't want to take it on. I mean, I know any number of Chicano historians who thought that a book should be written and needed to be written, but didn't want to be the person to do it. And honestly, that was my response. When people began to say to me, you should write the biography because you're in the best position to do it and you know the history and could do a good book, my first response was, you know, I don't need to be that person either. And then it was, as I said, over time, really being persuaded that part of the reason that and historians who are friends of mine made this argument, that part of the reason people don't know who he is, and they really, I mean, obviously people here in this room know, but I go all over, and there are teachers, and there are people, including in California, and if you get outside of California in the Southwest, forget it. You know, that the reason that he is being forgotten is because he has been portrayed in such a one-dimensional way. Because he's been portrayed in such a one-dimensional way until now.
You go ahead.
So I spent some time thinking that I'm demeaning myself. And I'm going to try to take this and put it on a little bit more of a political level.
All right.
And there are a whole bunch of different ways that you can frame the political questions that you're facing. But when you say that he destroyed the union, that to me is a serious charge. And I'm not hearing in your talk the fact that actually the growers, the agribusiness interests, are incredibly powerful. The Republican Party in California is incredibly powerful. And there was, however you want to characterize it, there was a sustained counterattack on the UFO. The fact that they actually won as much as they did at that particular moment, Boyd Todd and the strikes in the late 60s and early 70s, could be considered a rather major miracle. So my question is, do you take the position that if Caesar had not had the imperfections that you document, that the Union would in fact have not been defeated?
I think there's absolutely no way to know what would have happened. I think you should read both my books, particularly the first one as well, which goes into great detail about what actually happened during that time period. I don't disagree, and I think I spoke today, you know, at some length about the power that he was up against and the remarkable nature of the victories that he did achieve. He achieved those victories, or the Union achieved those victories, when, you know, Ronald Reagan was the governor of California and Richard Nixon was the president, and you cannot get a more staunch Republican opposition than that. So purely the fact that there were Republican opposition was not enough to defeat the Union at its peak. I think that it's quite clear, and I would welcome having a conversation with you about this after you read both books, that the documentation shows that there was a point in time when it was a functioning labor union, it had contracts, it had members, and it fell apart. Now, whether over time the power of the union would have disintegrated as well, but, you know, he took a series of actions, including getting rid of a generation of farm worker leaders who were the future leaders of that organization, and he made those choices. So I think there's ample documentation to hold him accountable for important changes and junctures in the union's fortunes. Whether over time the UFW would have continued to succeed or not, I mean, I think there's no way to know that. So I don't minimize the power of the growers or the Republican opposition, but I think there clearly are actions that he took that put the Union on a certain course.
Hello, Miriam. I'm curious about historical figures who have a sense of their place in history, our founding fathers as a prime example. And you alluded that he certainly was aware of that, even in allegedly private papers and documents. I'm curious if you have a sense of when he started to realize that, when that dawned, that this was going to be something he was known for and that history would look upon him in that way. And I'm also curious if there was anything in those papers you went through where he slipped a little and forgot to put an eye to that.
It's a great question, and certainly by the late 1960s, he was aware of it, and certainly I think the entrance of Phil Mason and the decision to preserve the archives was something that enforced that sense in him of the importance of preserving it. He began to tape things extensively in the late 1960s. And I often tell this story when I speak to groups. There's a slide that I show of Cesar Chavez lying in bed. For much of 1969, he was flat on his back and he couldn't get up, and he had great troubles. And there's a picture of him that I found in the archives where he's flat on his back and he has to hold on a bar in order to sit up. There are 32 pages of photos in the book, which actually I'm really proud of, because there are also many photos that have never been seen before. So anyway, in March of 1969, thanks to Marion Moses, who is here today, Dr. Janet Trevell, who was the White House physician for President John F. Kennedy, who also had back problems among his other medical issues, Dr. Trevell came to Delano to examine Chavez. And she watched him walk in great pain across the room at a Friday night meeting, and she thought that she knew what was wrong with him. And the next morning, she went to examine him, and he was prone in bed and couldn't sit up without assistance. And she told him that he had a severe case of asymmetry. His left side was longer than his right side, and we're all slightly asymmetric, but in him it was quite acute, and that was what was causing his pain. And he's just ecstatic. He's elated because he expected her to say that he needed to be in traction or needed surgery or needed something dramatic. And what she said was, you know, you can even it out by putting something underneath a shoe, and you can sit in a rocking chair and you can do all this stuff. And so he calls in friends and his brother to tell them this great news. And Dr. Trevell looks at Richard Chavez and says, "You're a little crooked too, but not as much." And Cesar says, "We're freaks. We could be in a circus." And Marion goes out to try to buy him a blanket to cover his knees. And she also tells him that he has a Venus de Milo foot. This is my favorite part of the story, which means that your second toe is longer than your first toe. And it's called a Venus de Milo foot because that's how Michelangelo sculpted Venus de Milo. And if in ordinary mortals like us, it causes a lot of pain when you walk on it. So how do I know all this? I know this because he recorded the entire examination. And, you know, it was for me as a biographer an amazing moment to pull out one of these boxes of reel-to-reel tapes, and it just said Trevell on it, and I knew that was the name of the doctor, but I didn't know what was on the tape, and then to hear this entire two-hour examination and conversation. And I, you know, think it's an important story for many reasons, one of which is to think about the sense of history that someone has, the sense he had of his own place in history, that he's in acute pain when she comes to examine him, and yet, you know, has the presence of mind to make sure that it's tape recorded while, you know, John F. Kennedy's personal doctor examines him. So clearly by the late 1960s, he had that sense, and that was before he was on the cover of Time magazine and before, you know, a lot of the more famous moments in the history.
Miriam, you heard about the Faith Healing in the book, right?
Yes.
Somebody asked a question, when do you think things, when I came back here, you know, I worked in the union for a short time, I went to medical school and I came back, and that was one of the first things I noticed about Cesar. You know, I thought he was gone a little bonkers, you know, but he really thought
that he could heal people by touching them, yeah. But there were people, I mean, the cult of the personality was such at that point that when he would say that he could do this, people would agree, and people would say they were cured when he, you know, touched them and something came out of their ear, and so.
That's an interesting, I mean, if one of his heroes was Mahatma Gandhi.
Yes.
And same sort of thing generated about him, and he also had the same sort of, I'm going to prevent the British in this particular way from getting their way. I'm going to get my way. I'm going to outsmart the British, because basically, it's talked about as a nonviolent movement. But it was really the legal mind of Mahatma Gandhi knowing what would win against the British, and there was plenty of violence in the background, even if
right.
They,
and the same thing was
yeah,
true.
Yeah, same
about
sort
Cesar
of
Chavez.
Same sort of situation. So I find that very interesting because, as you said, maybe not perfect, but in both cases, and you're saying Cesar Chavez's legacy is disappearing, but Mahatma Gandhi's is not. And he was also a person who moved his group forward in a way which they are all happy for, and therefore the legacy should continue. And they're very similar in some other ways, too, because I mean, Mahatma Gandhi had plenty of things about the way he lived his life, especially towards the end, that people ignore.
Right. And a lot of revisionist books have come out recently even about Gandhi.
Right.
So, Mario Bustamante, one of the farm worker leaders of the 1970s and 80s.
You can either speak loudly and it'll get repeated or, Great.
Yo he campesino como por unos 25 o 30 años.
I was a farm worker for 25, 30 years.
Y me tocó empezar a trabajar desde 1964 en el Valle Imperial.
I began working in 1964 in the Imperial Valley.
Y conocí a César Chávez en 1969.
And I knew Caesar in, I met Caesar in 1969.
Y mi primer huelga. Entonces me tocó vivir lo que era sin unión, me tocó luchar por la unión.
Right. So in other words, I got to live in a time when there was no union, and I got the opportunity to struggle and fight for it.
Cuando no había unión, trabajábamos demasiadas horas desde que salía el sol, muchas veces hasta que se ocultaba.
When there was no union, we worked many hours, many times from when the sun had not come up to when the sun went down.
Y para 1900, el último contrato que tuvimos en 1980, nuestros beneficios habían subido demasiado, nuestro logro.
And by 1980, the last contract we had in 1980, our benefits were tremendous. They've grown tremendously.
Pero desgraciadamente duró ese último beneficio muy poco. La razón fue porque la unión, o sea, César ya no quiso organizar.
And the reason that I believe is because the union, the Caesar, self-organized.
Y todo se perdió.
And
entonces ahorita, 30 años después,
and now, 30 years later,
nadie, yo miro que en veces hay propaganda en la televisión de la unión.
Later, no one is organizing. Sometimes
pero los files no va
nadie. I see announcements on the television or in the news, but no one's going to the fields.
En Calexico, aún siguen pasando 10,000 personas a las 2 de la mañana.
In Calexico, 10,000 people still today cross the border at 2 in the morning.
O sea, la gente se muere joven.
In other words, people are still dying young.
Que no hay llenos de tiendas.
Because nobody's attending.
Yo me gusta mucho lo que Marvin Powell ha escrito porque siempre tengo la esperanza que alguien vea que hace falta en el campo.
And he says, I really appreciate what Miriam's written because I always have the hope that someone will see what's still missing today in the fields, and it won't be done.
Alguien que quiera luchar por las personas que están ahí.
Somebody that wants to fight and struggle for people that are there.
I think,
she just repeat what he said, that the key thing about the reason, the union.
Well, the union had not, the union
stopped organizing.
And in practical terms, I mean, just to underscore this, there are the number of farm workers covered by contracts today in California is minuscule. The contracts that they have are very weak contracts. When in the contract that Mario is talking about in 1980, lettuce workers were making $20 an hour. You know, they're now working in $1980, and they're, you know, generally working for minimum wage now, and at least we have a higher minimum wage in California than in other places. But so the conditions in the fields are very bad. I think, and that's what Mario was saying, that I think, and to me, one of the reasons to talk about what did happen and what is happening is for people to realize what the conditions are now, and that someday someone will come along, and that farm workers will again become visible and empowered in the way that they were at the height of the movement. And for a generation, for his generation of farm workers, the union made an enormous difference. And the legacy today is both the farm workers and the volunteers who came into the union and worked for it, who have gone on and, you know, organized for social justice movements and learned from what they did in the union. And the tragedy is that is not helping farm workers today. It's helping lots of other people, but not the farm workers. So the answer is hopefully yes.
Yes.
Yes, I was wondering whether how much you believe that Caesar's legacy is slipping away. I mean, it is a state holiday here in California.
I think the question is how much the legacy. I think the legacy is slipping away, and it's disappearing. I mean, I ask when I talk all over California and the rest of the country too, and even young people, you ask them what they learn in school. I mean, there actually is a requirement along with the fact that it's a state holiday that there's supposed to be a curriculum, but there's almost nothing actually written that teachers could use to teach about it to begin with. And given all of the other demands of the Common Core and everything else, it just, you know, it disappears. So, I would just quote again, the United States Labor Secretary, who comes from a farm worker background and who said, you know, people just know he had something to do with farm workers, and that's about it. And I mean, I'm from New York, and when you get to the East Coast, you know, forget it. I mean, there's some increased awareness of his name because of President Obama and because of the growing, you know, numbers of Latinos and particularly Mexican Americans, and so there is an effort, sometimes referred to as hispandering, to name things like, you know, there is now a USS Cesar Chavez that is a naval ship. You know, there is a national monument. His home in La Paz is now a part of the National Park Service. So, I mean, to the extent that increases his profile at some point, I think that's great, but it doesn't in and of itself accomplish much.
I was just going to add something. Mm-hmm. Farm laborers, and now the assembly has passed but not funded
a mandate, right?
To acknowledge these people, but it does not mean much if Cesar Chavez is not
right. Yeah, I mean, there's an issue. The question was about there is now a bill that was passed to include the history of the Filipinos in the farm worker movement, and he was saying that he had done some interviews with Filipinos, but given that people don't know who Cesar Chavez is, it even is a harder lift. The Filipinos do feel like they have been ignored in the struggle. The union that actually launched the grape strike in 1965 was a Filipino union called AWOC, the Agricultural Workers Organization Committee. So they do have an important part in history, and that's something that I think also needs to be more fully documented.
I think it's an interesting flip side of the hero worship, you know, that have to be perfect, that people will complain if people weren't heroic enough. One of the most ironic things along that line that I've come across, totally irrelevant to this, was that when Joseph Heller died, the author of Catch-22, there were critics who said he only wrote one good novel. I mean, I don't think the critic did write that one. And I think what's interesting, I mean, maybe his name is not attached to part of the legacy, but the whole idea of having the great boycott and having the consumers say, no, we won't cooperate, we won't buy that in order to help some other people. Or nowadays it's much more, would you spend 15 cents more per pound in order to get organic? Or would you spend $2 more per pound to get organic? Would you spend more? That's very, very common, and lots of people are doing it, at least in California.
And I'll tell you that the most successful farm worker organizing going on today is in Florida, and it's a group called the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, who have very decidedly did not form a union. They are a worker center. And they succeeded in using a lot of the tactics that the UFW pioneered, like boycotts and organizing students and getting a penny per pound more for tomatoes, and that they have actually forced some of the industry to sign agreements. I'll say one thing about the boycott quickly, which is that part of Chavez's sort of genius as an organizer was his ability to do what he called organizational jujitsu, which is to use the strength of the opponent against them. And the boycott was actually, although it was a consumer boycott and we asked people not to buy grapes, the thing that actually won the contracts in 1970 was the fact that because farm workers and domestic workers are still not covered under the National Labor Relations Act, they're the only two categories of workers other than in the state of California where we have a law, farm workers have no right to join a union and no right to petition for an election. But because they're not covered by the NLRA, they're also not subject to its restrictions. And under the NLRA, you cannot do what's called a secondary boycott, which is when I ask you not only not to buy grapes, but don't shop at Safeway if they sell non-union grapes. Well, because the farm workers weren't part of that, they were able to do a secondary boycott. And so what had been thought of as a strength by the growers, which is that farm workers were excluded, was actually turned on them. And what wins the grape boycott and what wins the contract isn't so much that we're not buying grapes. It's the pressure on three really large supermarket chains. And those executives finally say, you know what, we have labor unions, we have labor problems, we deal with them, you solve your labor problems. And that's what forces the growers, to sign contracts.
That's a great detail. That's a great historical detail. Time for one more question.
Just to add on, and it was a very important element in the Agricultural Labor Relations Act when it was passed in California, that it did not include a ban on the union.
And let me just add to on the hopeful question about can it happen again. You know, we have the Agricultural Labor Relations Act in California, which was negotiated by Jerry Brown as one of his first acts in office in 1975. He was a very strong supporter of the farm worker movement, and it is the most pro-labor law in the country. There are rights that unions have under that law that other unions would love to have in other industries. And it's there, it's on the books, it has not been weakened, and in fact it's been strengthened. And so, you know, someday someone can come along and use that law, hopefully.
You know, Jerry Brown, when he wrote his obituary of Caesar, was very, very interesting, because Caesar really wasn't for.
That's right, he was not for the law.
That was
right.
Jerry Brown's thing. And the interesting thing Jerry said in his obituary, in the Chronicle, I read in the Chronicle, he said Caesar was right.
I think he might have changed his mind by now.
Yeah.
Well, so ends another event of the Commonwealth Club in its 112th year of enlightened discussion, and we really want to thank all the participants that brought their own personal experiences of these 30 years. We really appreciate that you came and shared with us. Thank you very much.